Hello, this is The Interview and I'm Carrie Gracie. Today we discuss Islam and Islamism. And we do so not with a Muslim, but with a white, middle-aged British atheist who argues that all religious belief is without reason or dignity. Martin Amis is one of the best-known novelists of his generation in Britain, but recently he's made more headlines with his views on Islamism than with his fiction, and he's just published a book called The Second Plane, which collects all his writings since September the 11th, 2001, about the way the events of that day changed and go on changing our world. Martin Amis, welcome to the interview.
Thank you.
Before we get into the arguments, I think it might help the audience to get a few litmus test questions sorted out. So I'd like a yes or no answer to the following. Starting with, did you support the war in Afghanistan?
Yes.
Did you support the war in Iraq?
No.
Have you ever been a Christian?
Yes, when I was 8 or 9.
And when did you stop being a Christian?
When I was 11.
And have you read the Bible?
Not straight through.
Have you read the Quran?
Not straight through. I've spent hours with both, but not straight through.
Okay, well, let's talk then about September the 11th and how it's changed the world, if indeed it has. Before the big picture, your picture, how has it changed your world?
I didn't expect an event of that size and that suddenness. I think we forget just how sudden it was to occur in my lifetime. And, you know, I went through, I suppose, what everyone went through, which was incredulity, shock, a kind of fever in the first few months. Then, you know, and this book records that journey of just trying to bring a sort of high-level common sense to the whole thing, unaffiliated, not connected with any wing or, you know, lobby, to see it with an independent mind.
We'll talk about the high-level common sense in a moment, but first, Islam, terrorism, the politics of the Muslim world. Were these things you had thought about or written about before September the 11th?
No, and I think in common with 99% of Westerners, Islam was a kind of invisible history that was coexisting with ours and suddenly filled the sky. I mean, it's true that we were given notice of this. You could say the Iranian Revolution of 1979, the fatwa against Salman Rushdie in 89, but this was all from Iran. And then there was the first attempt on the World Trade Center, and it was bubbling around beneath the surface, but then the sky-filling event. But it does seem to me that, you know, if there is a kind of Islamist conspiracy theory, it is that the West is trying to destroy Islam. But the average Westerner had no awareness of Islam, I think, until 2001.
So it might have been even worse that the West was destroying Islam by accident?
Well, the argument given by Said Qutb and picked up by Khomeini...
You might have to explain who some of these people are.
Said Qutb is known as the father of Islamism. His book, Milestones, is known as the Mein Kampf of Islamism.
And although by those who would wish to criticise it rather than presumably by his followers.
Yes, I suppose so, yeah. But it was his contention that America would destroy Islam not by invasion but by example. In the Quran, Satan is not seen as a, you know, fire-breathing devil. He's seen as a tempter. And the very last words of the Quran are that insidious tempter who whispers in the ears of men. And this is what Khomeini means when he calls America the great Satan, and by extension Israel, the little Satan, is that, and it's an extraordinary notion that good Muslims will look at America and be tempted by it. And this will set in train contradictions that will destroy Islam. That is the line.
Before we continue down that path, I just want to get back to you for a moment and September the 11th, 2001. Are you afraid it might happen again? Does it dominate your thinking about the world you live in? Does it still fill the sky, as you put it?
You can tell it does, up to a point, because I can never look at an aeroplane now in the sky without thinking of it as a weapon. There has been a change of consciousness. I think, you know, what is fairly inevitable is that advances in munitions and weaponry will more or less guarantee, for instance, a dirty bomb attack. I sometimes think that the crisis that we face is really one of munitions glut. So impulses are translated into violent action much more easily.
And we've left you behind again. What made you go from the novelist study to grapple with all of this, not just in fiction, but in essays and journalism?
I'll take this as a personal question. I used to be studiedly apolitical, and I had lots of left-wing friends who, you know, were socialist workers and communist members and other allegiances. These were in the, this was in the 70s, late 60s, 70s. But then when I became aware of the reality of nuclear weapons, I found myself writing a book about that. And a little later, I wrote a book about the Holocaust novel. And then I came to write a book about Stalin, which I finished just around the turn of the century. And I felt what I was doing as I wrote that book was giving myself a political education, which I hadn't really had. I was all literary up until then. So when 2001 happened, it sort of coincided with my personal evolution, and I felt I did have, you know, a very crude command of precedents and categories and arguments, and that I, you know, could broach it. And anyway, I did. I mean, I was moved to do it.
And you talk about approaching it from no affiliation, but from a high-level common sense. That's where you got the high-level common sense from?
From those studies. Mm. Yeah, and from, you know, not being affiliated. I mean, one thing I get sure and sure about is that ideology is the Satan of human impulse, that it's always violent for intelligible reasons. It's something that human beings get hold of and it invades them. And it's always an embrace of illusion, and that's why it's violent. When you accept a belief system that is imperfect, as they all are, naturally, and this includes religion, and it's challenged, you can't defend it with mind alone. So the fists tighten and the response is glandular, and, you know, violence is the first recourse.
Because you say the response is glandular, now some people will think, what?
Yeah, I mean, even the clunking ideology we call levelism or egalitarianism or multiculturalism, relativism, PC, etc., which, you know, whose one idea is mildness, has violence glinting within it, as I've seen many times. I have it sort of directed at me.
PC, we should say, you mean politically correct?
Yeah. It's hardly a belief system, it's more a kind of polite fiction that it has some very beautiful ideas in it. It's a marvelous coincidence that this ideology now meets something ferociously ideological, Islamism, jihadism, which is an ideology within a religion, is a two-ply ideology. And I think that the West, large sections of the West, are so stupefied by the blandnesses and the polite fictions of political correctness that they're floundering around.
Which is in some ways an answer to my next question, but I'd like you to deal with it frontally as well. After 6 years, 6 years since September the 11th, how has it changed the world around us, apart from this confrontation between the blandness of the political correct and the ferocious two-ply ideology, the crisis of munitions and all those munitions flying around the sky? What are the other things, or what's the central change in our world?
Well, I mean, this is perhaps pat, but it does seem to me that the ancilla, the handmaiden of terror, is boredom. What I mean by boredom is not airport queues, although that's very boring, and the quantity of boredom in our lives has risen steeply, but more a kind of nullity in the debate, in that we're faced with an irrationalist and agonistic opponent. By agonist, I mean the acceptance of an implacable hostility that cannot be appeased, that is perhaps eternal. Nothing we can do is going to appease it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Are you sure? I mean, I'm just thinking that, for example, Osama bin Laden, who must be one of these implacable figures in the cast, he started off with some fairly specific political objectives.
Yes,
removing troops, American troops from Saudi Arabia, a change in American foreign policy towards Israel and Palestine.
Yes, but and if you gave him those things, do you think he'd say thanks very much and that would be the end of it? Zawahiri and bin Laden have said that their intention is to restore the caliphate. you think, you know, we give them the caliphate, you think they'll be satisfied with that. What follows from that is that...
The caliphate, we ought to explain. The
caliphate came to an end in the middle of the 13th century when the last caliph, as he's known, was kicked to death by Hulagu's outriders, the Mongols, taking Baghdad. And now, you know, the core Islamist idea is to restore the caliphate, to have an Islamic army which will, you know, it's fantastic, all this, but would either conquer other countries or exact tax from them to leave them alone.
Before we go any further, I ought to get your definition of Islamist.
Well, I think Francis Fukuyama has refined it for us, where he says...
The American historian.
Historian. We need a third category, he said, because you have Islam, then you have Islamism, which can mean many things. It can describe the government in Turkey, for instance, which is now trying to undo what Ataturk did and desecularize Turkey. But not necessarily expansionist, revanchist, imperialist like the hard wing.
Or quite avowedly not, in fact.
No. The third category is jihadism, which is homophobic, misogynistic, irrationalist, totalitarian, imperialist, genocidal. They want the restoration of the caliphate. They want to convert or execute all infidels. And if you get bored with what they want to do to us, the Crusaders and the Jews and the Masons, you can look at what they want to do to all Hindus and Buddhists and all the rest. And also to within their own religion, they want to kill or convert or punish all the Shia.
Is there a danger, though, of lumping all these people together? Because it sounds to me like there's a considerable spectrum, and
that's what we haven't done. We've made these three categories.
Yes, except that others would perhaps make more and would say that, in fact, Islamism, a definition might be somewhat simpler, is to say it's those who wish to deny a line between politics and religion in the Islamic world. It's not particularly a manifesto of objectives which refer to anyone beyond the Islamic world.
Well, that little sect is no doubt represented too. I mean, it's very fissiparous and very, you know, full of conflict within each position.
I mean, I suppose the reason why I'm pressing is because there is a fundamental argument in terms of the analysis within the West, isn't there, about what's going on. And there are those who say there are political reasons, there are not reasons necessarily, but there's a political history to quite a lot of this. We've been a journey which involved imperialism in the Middle East in the early 20th century, the oil industry, which involved a lot of involvement in overturning one regime and another, which involved the creation of the State of Israel and the disempowerment of Palestinians, and the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, etc., etc.
You can't include the events that follow September the 11th.
Well, some people would, in terms of saying what is going on, for example, in contemporary Iraq, wouldn't they? Which is presumably part of your picture of apocalyptic revenge.
Revenge. You see, I think you're making the fundamental error in that what you're practicing here is rationalist naivety. You're assuming that this is tit for tat, business as usual.
I'm not practicing anything, but what I would like to... I think that what I'm saying is that there are some people who take this line and are often people with a lot of experience in thinking about this. I mean, to quote you, one of them, former CIA Bin Laden unit chief Michael Scheuer, said, "Politicians are at great fault for not squaring with the American people. We're being attacked for what we do in the Islamic world, not for who we are or what we believe in or how we live."
Yeah, and you can get a dozen quotes saying the opposite.
Yeah.
Let's say that the people who do say that are making the mistake of imputing rational, historical cause and effect to something that is much more intense and magical than these arguments.
It doesn't necessarily... Are they saying it's rational? It doesn't have to be a rational response that they're saying. They're just saying there is A, and B possibly is partly following A.
Yeah.
Not necessarily rational. It could be your hormonal, glandular, knee-jerky type response that you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah, and I think the history of it is very deep, and in fact goes back to before the existence of America. It is in its, you know, emotional core, revanchist. We have to remember just how astonishing the rise of Islam was. For centuries, you know, what would have been inculcated in you as a Muslim would be a complete concordance between your desires and God's for you. And this is why I think Israel is absolutely at the core of this, because the war that was necessary to bring about the establishment of Israel in 1948 is known in Arab lands as al-Nakba, the catastrophe. Israel defeated three Arab armies and three other countries' supplementary forces. Geographically, Israel occupies 0.06 of Muslim lands, of Arabic lands. So it would be like New Jersey defeating America, rightly as it called the catastrophe, but also, you know, not just a military reverse repeated in 6 days, 20 years later. If you devoutly and passionately believe that there is a God who is minutely attentive to your desires and deserts, what does it mean when this sort of defeat is visited on you? We use the word humiliation very lightly. What kind of humiliation is it when it seems to be coming from history and also from God? 1948 was when Said Qutb began to formulate the, you know, and there it is, the exterminatory view of America. And this is filtered through now into Islamist jihadist thought.
That's your analysis of where it's coming from. It is actually coming from something in history anyway, rather than just coming from religion. You're not arguing that the problem comes just from religion.
No, but religion is a great incubator of these great hurts. Hatred of the Jews, contempt for the Jews, is very deep, of course, in Islam.
I suppose what I'm getting at is it, at the end of the day, political, or is it something to do with religion? Because, you know, similarly, we've got 1,000 years of European Christian baggage, some of which is extremely prejudiced against Muslims, for that matter, or indeed Arabs, for that matter.
No, I mean, Islam is 6 or 7 centuries younger than Christianity. You might say, semi-facetiously, that it's on schedule, because in the 13th century we had the Inquisition, and as vile and vicious as anything history has seen. The impulse is not, I don't think, from Islam, which is as open to interpretation as any other, you know, creed, any other, and Quran as any other holy book. You can see it as a marvelously peaceful document. You can, if you're so minded, see it as a sort of a munitions arsenal.
And it's worth saying, you know, at this point, that of course, of the 1.5 billion Muslims that there are in the world, most of them are seeing it just as peacefully as the Christians are seeing the Bible.
I think 99%, 98% of Muslims are very distressed by the rise of Islamism, hate it, horrified by it, and are finding it very difficult to assert themselves against it, just as not many residents of Spain in the 13th century said, I think the Inquisition has gone a bit far, because you know what would happen to you.
Just a reminder for anyone just joining us that you're listening to the interview in the BBC World Service with me, Carrie Gracie, and my guest today, the British writer Martin Amis. Martin, you talk about Islam in this context as if it's just a few hundred years down the road from Christianity and its evolution, and yet In your writing on the subject, you've talked about the extreme incuriosity of Islamic culture, a tradition of intellectual autarky. You almost seem to be making a kind of exceptionalist statement about all religions being bad, but Islam being particularly troublesome.
Only because of its great, you know, glorious rise. I think this state of mind I tried to describe earlier, where you feel you're in accord with God's covenant. By God, you know, you look around and empires are crumbling to you. The mass conversions, it would make the head spin, you know, over centuries, that kind of vast geohistorical success. And we all know that Islamic learning, without it, we would have not had our Renaissance, or not in that form. And if we hadn't had the Renaissance, we wouldn't have had our Enlightenment, and we wouldn't be at the evolutionary point we are now. And when I talk about incuriosity, I mean the fact, for instance, that Spain translates more books into Spanish every year than have been translated into Arabic in the last 1,000 years.
And yet, I mean, the head-spinning success which turned into failure, other huge cultures have seen it. The Chinese saw it at the end of the 18th and during the 19th century. And you could argue that there's a similar head-turning problem going on in the West today.
Oh, yeah. I think this extraordinary phenomenon that we call anti-Americanism and anti-Zionism as well is exactly the same kind of impulse, but wearing a slightly, you know, quieter get-up. I think our anti-Americanism in this country is all to do with losing the central role on the planet after the Second World War, decisively to the Americans.
And what then about those who say, well, we're currently living under the boot of an American empire, and that the Americans are having a problem with the same hubris that others have had before?
Yeah, it'll be interesting for my children to watch what happens when American power starts to fade.
And some would say it's already happening.
Yeah.
Would say that Iraq has been a wake-up call in that respect.
The design behind the Iraq War, one suspects, was simple projection of American power. And as you say, the result has been the exact opposite of that, a real diminution, the end of the American domination of the Middle East. That period is coming to an end.
Now, you talk in your most recent book about the many fatal flaws in your view of Islamism, and we've set out your apocalyptic vision of the nature of Islamism. Now, if it's as flawed as you say, surely it's going to self-destruct.
Yeah, I think talking about jihadism is so poisonous, that it's so psychotic that it can't last. The reason it's got going is the way Bolshevism and Nazism got going. It's to do with a double negation. You negate the value of human life, which very extreme cults always establish that. And the other one is the rejection of reason. And it's very striking in the writings of Stalin and Lenin and Hitler that they never let the word reason go by without putting a scornful adjective in front of it, like abject or cowardly. And for a while, once you do that, everything looks possible, including the caliphate.
But can't we then leave it to its own contradictions to self-destruct?
I think that's probably what will happen. Because once you do that, the ground turns to mire beneath your feet, and you see that actually rationalism, which is not as strong a force as we like to think, but is nonetheless more closely identified with reality, will reassert itself. And, you know, not everything is possible. You get to learn that.
Just before we close, I want to go back to talking about you for a moment, because your views are controversial. They'll be controversial to anyone who is a religious believer. They'll be controversial to many Palestinians, I'm sure. And they're controversial in the UK to the liberal intelligentsia that you emerge from. I'm going to just quote back at you something that you said which caused a lot of problems for you. So after the 2006 plot to blow up various aircraft in the skies over the Atlantic, and of course after the 2005 bombings that we saw on the London transport system, you said you felt a definite urge to argue that British Muslims in general must suffer for the actions of suicide bombers until they got the house in order, strip search people who look like they're from the Middle East or from Pakistan, not let them travel, further down the road, deportation. Now, this was called by one commentator as odious an outburst of racist sentiment as any public figure has made in the UK for a long time. Is it fair comment?
It's a stupid idea. And you must remember that it was the day after the third scheme in 13 months to massacre my fellow citizens. That same day, I abandoned the idea. It caused no comment at the time, because it was a time of great anger. The plan was to kill 3,000 people on routes used by my family every summer. I don't think it's so vile to have taken that seriously. As Nabokov said, I think like a genius, I write like a distinguished man of letters, I talk like an idiot.
Russian-American novelist.
It's the sort of thing you know, I did feel that urge, and if our discourse were in a healthier position, I think we should confess to these urges. It wasn't a racist remark anyway. It becomes racist because you're not going to start persecuting Norwegians because of what happened in the London Underground and what might have happened above the skies of the Atlantic. It's not a racist urge, it's a retaliatory urge. The people, the community from which this is coming is defined. If Al-Qaeda were in Norway, then I would have said people from Norway. It's not a racist urge, it was simply anger. And I think we value interpretability too highly. I mean, it is not really a racist issue, it's an ideological issue.
Well, that's another huge question which we'll have to answer another day. Martin Amis, thank you very much for joining us on the interview.
Thank you.